Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects is back on the air. Unbelievable. It's good to hear, see you all out there. Thank you for joining me today. This is the 7th of February 2016. This is the 38th day of the year. Man, there's only 328 days left. But the exciting part is we have, 41 days and 14 hours to the March equinox. So the likes of me and some of you will find that our life is in balance for those few precious moments, thanks to the universe. It's a lofty day today. Thank you for the response to last week's show. That's very much appreciated, and thank you to all who are able to share this site with other fellows who you think might be interested in some of the ideas that that I put out there. Some of them are from our conversations, and some of them are just things that our conversations trigger. I'm always looking, like you, into those corners for answers that are so far seemed to escape us. And it's all in the service of coming to grips with the purpose and fundamental nature of Freemasonry. Today's commentary is referred to as being outed. The morphing of Freemasonry, or how good men are duped. I know, way out there on thin ice one more time. It occurs to me that in order to move forward, there needs to be some acknowledgement, I think, of where we seem to have most difficulty. And our difficulties aren't malicious. They're because of sensibilities. And that said, I want to speak with you about that. How can we, I think it is possible that there is sustainable growth within Masonry. And that requires a balance of the innovation of new and respect for a sensitivity to respect in all its different shapes. I was just going to do like a lot of people do, start to define it. But you know what respect is. I noticed that there are some things about the craft that we tend to ignore over the years. Or we're distracted by other business at hand. One of those things has to do with the respect of being in uniform, and that in and of itself, that's not a criteria for Masonry, because we were left really trying to appreciate, or we should, whether wearing certain symbols and adopting certain protocols for recognition is a form of a tacit commitment to a form of collective respect. I say that because from what I know, Freemasonry is about the development of an individual, not just in terms of whether he can slim down and look like a proper and fit man, which hasn't been said out loud to a lot of fellows, or if ever. But the intellectual and emotional development to ensure that a man is living his life well-read and able to understand the more noble ideas and questions that pursue a man through the course of his life. That said, it struck me that that's a topic that needs, I think, discussion. Because it's not, if we make the assumption that my sense of respect for the craft is the same as yours, then I think we could see where that would be kind of difficult without saying the words and really understanding what we're meaning. Is the order one of, is it a collective? Is it, and is there an expectation of compliance and uniformity? Is there an explanation or an expectation of the right of the individual? Sort of the condition that we had in Greece. You know, when each citizen was responsible to the state, each person, for example, the leaders, the military leaders, were elected by the people, the voters. Women and slaves didn't have votes in those days, in this period. The responsibility for the defense of the state rested on the shoulders of each and every member. In Athens, Plato did military service well into his past his middle age, and he was credited with being a good soldier and doing his bit in the defense of the state. Do we have that notion in mind, that you're here? We have a lot of hints to show us that perhaps the order and the ritual triggers that kind of thing. It's you, and then the welcome, the exception to the principles and purpose that are going to be shared with you. Now, let's not get tedious about what's happened with that claim right now. Let's just move ahead and say it is an expectation. And the ritual is about you, the individual. And us, the people that are, you know, you hear that we're not expecting to be disappointed, that we are expecting that we've made a good choice. We no need to get into the details of that because this is an open airline. Now, for somebody, and no need to shy away from it either, but it does shift a balance when the individual begins to say that they're not really sure about the quality of the experience for them. Does this mean that we have somehow created a process of masonry that is valuable to a small, relatively small proportion of the overall membership. And that out of all of the people, all of the apprentices that come to the door asking for an opportunity to study in the studios with the great masters, very few actually make the test, actually achieve the test. Is it that kind of thinking? Or are we saying that regardless of the Freemasonry is not a studio of the elite, but it's schooling, and that as the standard within the school is made known to the students, to the apprentices, and they're put to task, organized with study, and answerable to their mentors. Mentors who actually express a fondness and affection and a shared need for the success of each and every student. That seems to be perhaps what people are sincerely looking for. And then in the wings we have cynics who say that is idealism. That is not something that can be achieved by mortal men. Well, if anything, I think it's been pretty clear that we make the impossible possible through Freemasonry. So we are maybe at odds with some of that language and some of that thinking. That we live in practical terms as practical men, but we strive for the ideal. That is it Portia that says, perfect is not good enough? Not their corporate slogan. Here's how I think that we're morphing, that Freemasonry has been morphing. And I playfully call it how good men like you and I have been duped. Moving forward while preserving trust. While we have been getting older, 62 people accumulated as much wealth as one half the population of Earth. History tells us that imbalances like this are always resolved under attack. Rome outlawed hubris. It was wrong-minded and provocative to lord riches and rank above citizen. They eventually repealed that law, fell into moral, economic, and military decline. I'm not saying that their decline was because of the repeal of the laws against hubris. Once again, wealth has become a symbol of greed. Men who have nothing, when they lose hope, are in danger. Children are starving and dying. The diaspora in the millions are heading to the West. Agribusiness has replaced the family farm, but wealth has been there to buy up acreage for estate living. I believe Freemasonry has enough resiliency to whether this instability, but what comes of this New Age Reformation will be changed. We will be changed. We still trade on genius and celebrity, pleased having some curb appeal, knowing thousands and thousands of contributions and acts of kindness eventually come together to define nations as they define us. We have never wanted to compete with cultural power. We share an unassailable belief in the goodness of mankind, helping the misfortunate, and dedication to the advancement of humanity through arts and sciences, the two fascinations that define humanity. Not practical at all. We modernize as we always have. As a small group of men with an honorable history and enduring moral alternative. Freemasonry, the enduring moral alternative. It's interesting to think that we encompass this type of language within the Order of Freemasonry is a bit daunting. It's a bit challenging. It means we really need to set to work. And we need to not dismiss the excellent work of men who have lived earlier. In other words, we need to be students of them. Just as they hoped that their efforts would benefit and improve generation by generation and lead to the likes of us, they weren't sure of the downside. They couldn't see it coming. But moral men did. The greed, the tolerance of suffering, the control, the amassment of wealth. Well, if we haven't learned the lesson yet, we will, because the lesson and the decline is always and forever necessary. Because we just can't figure out how to distribute to the wanting. You and I, we do our piece, but we're an influence that has no satisfaction knowing what's coming and being unable to stop it. But maybe we're like butterfly wings. Maybe the turbulence created by butterfly wings does have an influence on the air mass moving around the earth, affected by the frictions of the mountains, of the seas. Maybe, in some small way, we will have altered the thinking and made it all right for people to make change and give people, good people, a framework when the change and adjustment does occur to move forward, just as we always have. We understand despots and demagogues. We absolutely do. We recognize them because they make themselves so evidently known. But in the meantime, important to hold up our end of the process. Here, I have a little bit of Canadiana going on here today. You'll like this, I hope. It's Diana Krall. It's raining outside.
I will be alone.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Here. I want us to be able to talk about the sensibilities of our craft. In tolerant dialogue, here's what I mean. Here's what I mean by that. You can, don't have to take my word for it, but back to some of the work done in the 12th century. And I hold up that as a measure. There is a dialogue between Peter Abelard's dialogue of a philosopher with a Jew and a Christian. And it's written in French between 1136 and 1139. And Raymond Lull's Libre des Gentils. This is a dialogue between a Christian and a Hindu about religion. And what there exists today very few early fictional dialogues written by Christians before 1750 that describe a confrontation between a Christian and a representative of Hindu, Buddhism, or other Asian religions. Let's not think that because we're accelerating knowledge today that great ideas didn't exist beforehand. Of course they did. Lull was written in Catalan, Abelard in French, in part because of their advocacy of religious tolerance. Abelard and Lull were accused of heresy. A few Protestant Christians also wrote interreligious dialogues, mostly between Protestant and Catholic interlocutors, you know, the people that explain. And some of these dialogues argued for some degree of religious tolerance, and of course, provoking the anger of less tolerant Protestants. What important text of this type was written even earlier by Giuseppe Maria's Christian Hindu dialogue as Matteo Ricci's The True Meaning of the Lord of Heaven, written in Chinese about 1603. And in it, a Christian and a Chinese scholar compare the moral, religious, and philosophical views of Christianity with those of Buddha, Lao Tzu, and Confucius. The need to write such dialogues in Asian languages, assuming that they were to be read by native Asians, may partly explain why relatively few were written, since there were relatively few missionary intellectuals resident in Asia with the necessary linguistic skills. But even earlier, we have a set of broader cultural dialogues written in Latin. This was produced and published from the Chinese city of Macau about 1590. The dialogues purport to record the impressions of Europe made by some young Japanese that the Jesuits had in fact sent here in 1582. Although some of the observations found in the dialogues may have originated from these Japanese visitors, the real authors of the text appear to have been European Jesuit missionaries in China and Japan. Alessandro Felignano and Eduardo de Sante. Even though they were written in Latin, the work was apparently intended in part for an audience of Japanese seminarians in Japan. In the case of India, a Roman Catholic catechism in the form of a dialogue was written in the Bengali language and published in 1599, the first printed book in Bengali. It was a dialogue between a Christian and a Hindu Brahmin, written in Bengali by a Bengali convert to Christianity named Antonio de Rosario, and was published about 80 years later. This is apparently the one clear precedent for Giuseppe Maria de Galano's Hindustani dialogue, but there is no evidence that he ever saw the text. And it's very obscure. Well, what we're hearing here, we can go on to talk about the Sanskrit and the early Upanishads. Some of you are students of those bits of work. And the famous dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, and it uses the common format of questions and answers between a student and a teacher. In this case, the student, Arjuna, does express a coherent alternative point of view. Allegorical and semi-allegorical Sanskrit theatrical dramas such as the Krishnamishra's Matavisala has contained philosophical and religious dialogues. So what we learn is we can see, just as the Christians, you know, were decided that December 25th was going to be the day to celebrate the birth of the Christ, which happened to be the same day celebrated by the Mithras faith, which also believed in resurrection, life after death. Not a bad appeal for Roman soldiers of the day. Can you imagine doing what they did? But what this reaffirms, these reference reaffirms, is the value of tolerant dialogue. So don't be, I want to encourage you, don't be afraid that you're the only one that thinks this way. Nobody will know that you exist unless you take that risk as a Mason to invite tolerant dialogue to occur. This protects you and me and distinguishes those that the ingredient that's necessary for these dialogues to take place is tolerance. Now let's pull back to the commentary today where I'm talking about respect. There has to be tolerance of the points of view brought out in the dialogue. For military people to think that the world would be a better place if everybody was trained in semi-military style doesn't stand well with the efforts. That's not a new thought. But history's taught us what happens when that type of an approach has been employed in real life. I'm not going to tell you what the results are. You go and do that research for yourself. Let's just say there are some very valid reasons why we don't have those states. They're referred to as totalitarian. Why is it that it stifles freedom of thought, freedom of faith, freedom of worship, freedom of congregation, assembly, I guess? I can't answer why it does, but it does. Point being made that we come to Freemasonry with our own unique backgrounds, our own unique histories. So making an assumption that one's own history is superior to that of anybody else is, well, maybe I should put some qualifiers on this, but those are one of what I refer to as the conceits. Now, conceit is in literature is an extended metaphor with a very complex logic that governs a poetic passage. By manipulating images and ideas, a conceit invites the reader into a more sophisticated understanding of an object of comparison. But we each collect our conceits more as an excessively favorable opinion of one's own ability, or our importance, or our wit. Something that's conceived only in the mind. It's a thought. In real time, do these things exist? Does a thought exist? Does an idea exist? So the tolerance really asks us to check that sense of conceit that, oh my, I'm not the most important. What comes out of me is valid only as opinion. That I can't, because I declare it, profess to even know truths. I have impressions of them, perceptions of truths. But to know them, obviously, that takes thought. But look at our history. The metaphysical conceit associated with metaphysical poets of the 17th century is a far more intricate and intellectual device. And talk about this, metaphysical conceits. Sets up an analogy between my spiritual qualities, my sense, my entity's spiritual qualities, and an object of the physical world. Can we do this, I guess, is the question. Is there a need? And I build on this because in previous commentaries, I've been talking with you about what we want and whether we have the willing to open ourselves to these ideas, willing to be humble, to think about a life without the where our conceits are in check, so that we can have that tolerant dialogue. Now, we chase knowledge, don't we? And here's something that I want to ask you about. I'm writing a paper I'll share with you later. But I'm on a section now about what happens with authority when it's unexamined or uncontrolled. Why, and the question is, why does authority always unchecked, always become overbearing? Why is that? Well, sit back in your comfortable place with it and get a good grip on whatever you're sipping while you're listening to this. Ask yourself and think about the authority of the arts and sciences. Now, there are authorities that are almost unassailable, aren't they? They're fact-based. Not opinion. Now, they may start as an idea or an opinion, but then the pursuit of information to support them is irrefutable. Or is it? And similar with the arts. The arts evoke emotion that help define us as human beings. Oh, and we need to grow up, become more mature, perhaps a little more urbane, in realizing that all of these discoveries aren't designed to make you and me happy. We'll leave that to Santa Claus and our mother and father. These are as the unvarnished world around us evoke that something is something. Are the surrealists evoking something so unpleasant because what we're seeing is discordant? It doesn't fit. Time, I'm not supposed to see time melting. I'm not supposed to see an object from different dimensions, perspectives at the same time. But when you understand Picasso, you understand Dali, Salvador Dali, with the intention of these techniques, then you can see that they were pushing the boundaries and pushing the boundaries of our own minds, where we can acknowledge that, oh my goodness, we can see more than one dimension at the same time displayed in front of us in a painting. And it is like nothing else we see in the reality around us, except if we pinch ourselves, we can actually reach out and touch that painting hanging on the wall in the gallery in front of us. It is part of our reality. It evokes a part of our thinking, a part of our mind that hasn't been tapped before. And then you and I can ask ourselves, emotionally, what effect is this having on us? What does it do when we find out that we can calculate that the sun is burning out? Well, it's not like a light bulb burning out. It takes 8 years for a neutrino to get from the core of the sun to the surface. And then, what, 12 minutes to get from the surface to us where it penetrates everything. It goes between the space and the molecules around us. And they're going through us. So in the 500 billion years that it's going to take for the sun to burn out, should we begin to quake and shake, lay awake at night anxiously? Think about it, boys and girls. We've been in existence, sentient beings, for how many hundreds of thousands of years? Hundreds of thousands. We haven't hit the... I think we'd be doing well if we hit the billion-year mark and we're surviving. Or the million-year mark and we're surviving. These are things that are almost irrelevant because they're beyond our capacity to understand them. Just beyond. So they become, this is where mathematics and philosophy begin to fold in on each other in a way. I think the tolerant dialogue within Freemasonry has been going on and continues. But you need to search it out. And unfortunately, too many of our new boys don't discover them. Perhaps that's just the impetuousness of youth, or the urgency with which drives them to free the doors of a Masonic lodge, hoping to find answers to questions they haven't been able to answer previously, searching for meaning. And you and I, we're not rash. These conversations are contemplative. We ruminate, we ponder, we think, we read, and in the meantime, we celebrate the process. What we've done is formalized ourselves as technicians in the lab. Is your laboratory a group of theologians? Mm-hmm. Then what I want to know is, what's the discussion about today? Not so much important about your own personal opinion, but what's the discussion in the lab today? What discoveries are going on? I'm more interested in that, to be honest with you, than at the end of the night after we've had a few rounds back and forth. Then you'll begin to reveal to me your impressions and opinions about what's been going on in the work that you do. So I don't want us all to have uniformity. I don't. That would frighten me. I want not the tedium of people's opinions to be coming out, or, you know, when you see some fop and he's just talking about himself. You get to see that, don't you? It happens in the strangest times and the strangest places, but it's not news. But I want to know what you're discovering. What is it you're discovering? What keeps you up at night? I'm going to slip in a little piece of music here. I think, I don't know if many of you have even heard this woman. I don't know if she's really produced anything commercially. Her name's Phoebe Layton. She's a Swedish singer. I discovered her when I was following YouTube series on sailing, and people that are cruising around the world and things like that. Her name's Phoebe Layton. Check it out. Thank you. Not to like. Phoebe Layton. So, are we good? It's interesting when we have these kind of talks. Talk about how within the order, the thousands and thousands of us, this kind of thoughtful conversation is taking place. You can see that it's not the kind of conversation that you'd want to advertise every single meeting, is it? But if you were to put it out there that, you know, we're going to get together and we're going to do something, we have some purpose to it, and we're a group of, you know, like-minded people in the room, and if there's always the possibility that a respectful dialogue will break out, it's okay. But one thing that would have, there are some few things that the lodge of the future would need to change in order to do that. I have to think of a nice term for the lodge of the future. It's like, for me, letting the genie out of the bottle. We'd have to escape the restraints of time. We can't do this. If you and I are getting together and we aren't going to have competition for our time, let's say we're on the golf course or we're on the shore and we're throwing a line in, do some fishing. Or throwing a leg over a bicycle, or climbing up into the saddle. They're special moments. Or you're joining me at the edge of the surf, where you have those nice little folding chairs so that your feet are in the in the water, warm ocean, and your bum is just a little bit above the sand. You have your fingers wrapped around a sundowner or two. You're sitting next to me, and we're talking. Hey, we're not going to get into anything too heavy, are we? At least not when there's a beautiful sunset going on. The fragrance around is intoxicating. It's those moments when really interesting things just pop up. Now, we want that. We want that wonderful magic to happen in Masonic lodges, but we can't do it when we try to script it. We couldn't script it. So you and I are going to script that kind of magic. So remember that time when we were riding in the mountains of the Rockies outside of Banff? And we were in the hands of a wrangler and a herd of her horses. She took us into these incredible crevices and cross mountain streams. Well, let's just recreate that this month. Do you mind? What do you think? When we climbed out of the saddle, we went over to the old metal Coca-Cola cooler that was a bit battered and faded. Took out a bottle of the local and sat there and talked after we had unsaddled the horses. Gave them a bit of a rub down. You don't put a horse out wet, do you? Of course not. Remember that conversation? We were just a bit tired and exhausted from what we've gone through. We're leaning over the rail and the horses are just, dancing around. Some of them are just having that kind of drink out of the trough. And it's too early to feed them, of course. They're just cooling off, just like you and I. The scenery, the mountains in the background, the trees, it's magical. We can't recreate that. We experience that. The opening notes of the opera that just trigger that nerve deep in that memory deep in the mind. And you feel unexpectedly the hair on your arms tingle and stand up. You think, oh my goodness, what has happened to me? I'm a farmer's son. Were to want to pull back the cover of Shelley and sit down for an evening with a bottle of port and just read. Well, those are the special moments that are special because they're unique. What I like about your company is that you are men that are unique because of those things. Because you compete, like some compete with experiences. I've had more experiences than you have. I've climbed to the highest mountain. Okay. But the company that you offer me is because you're a bigger man. You're mature. You're thoughtful. And it's always a good time. There's never this debate about having fun. I mean, we're not children. We don't go out, let's go out and have some fun. Well, no. Come on out, we'll have dinner and talk. It's been a while since we've had a chance to get together. So I'm not sure. I know that periodically we can do that on a bigger scale. But with some frequency, that goes on with between two fellows or three fellows or four fellows, smaller groups. Step on my sailboat. It happens almost every time. Something breaks out. It's comfortable to sit back and relax. just floating along, stretched out, bit of a breeze, warm. Something breaks out. Doesn't have to be guided. Doesn't have to be rumination. Doesn't have to be intense. So we look for sharing those experiences with one another, and by golly, a tolerant dialogue will break out all by itself. See, Freemasonry isn't a child. It's a very old man. He's been around. Oh, he can still have those moments where he's in rough trade and has the give and take he had when he was young, but he doesn't have the same endurance anymore. But he enjoys just sitting back and watching other people do it. Absolutely enjoys it. And we enjoy his company because he seems to teach us, because we're so receptive and open-minded to him. He's the mentor, the great-grandfather that we need to open up our minds so that we feel safe. Whether we're a little Jewish boy or a Muslim boy or a Jainist or a Buddhist boy, it's all good. Where we're safe. Say you know that I'm intolerant of Philistines, coarse-minded, coarse-mouthed, ridiculously, either racist or homophobic types. I have no patience, or misogynists. I just find that so limiting. It's the rest. The absolute rest. Oh, excuse me. It's dry in here. I need something to keep it a little calmer, eh? I hope I'll see you again. I hope it's been worthwhile. That's enough. This is like too rich a cup. It's like, those little hors d'oeuvres. Sometimes you know, a little bit of pâté is nice, but you don't want to make a meal of it. I hope that you find your bliss and your inspiration within the inner depths of Freemasonry. Don't be put off by the superficial and the domestic. Those are things that the bills have to be paid, the garbage has to be taken out. Freemasonry. If Freemasonry was a woman, it would be a mistress to us all. Oh my, scandalous. It is scandalous in a way. This is more, remember when your grandfather put his hand on your shoulder as you were walking along and he's just chatting away, teaching. And you can remember the conversation and the day it was happening. That's Freemasonry. Because that's part of you. I look forward to having you join me again. I'm going to drop this off with a Canadian singer. This is a woman that was born in Russia. I think she's a Jewish girl. And then lived in Israel for a long time. Before we were fortunate enough to have her come here and make her home in Canada. Her name is Sophie Millman. She's has a beautiful voice, a beautiful soul, and she's here. I look forward to having you join me next week. It'll be Valentine's Day. Get ready, old smoothie. Bye for now.
Make just one someone happy. Make just one heart a heart to sing to. One smile that cheers you. One face that lights when it leaves you. One man's your you will live just as a golden minute with the real stack in life to claim. Once you have